Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are speaking with Natasha Hakimi Zapata, who is the author of the new book, Another World is Possible, Lessons for America from Around the Globe. Natasha Hakimi Zapata is joining us from London and is an award-winning journalist, university lecturer, and literary translator. Her work has appeared in The Nation, Los Angeles Review of Books, In These Times, and elsewhere. She is a former foreign editor of Truthdig. Natasha, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Hi, David. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for writing the book. What inspired you to do it? This was a lot of travel in the world for one book. What was the idea?
So the inspiration for the book is sort of two-sided in the sense that there was a professional inspiration and there was a personal inspiration. And I write about both in the book. And so the professional side of things is that I'm a journalist, as you said. I've been in progressive media for about 15 years now. And during that period, I had been writing, reporting, and reading a lot about progressive issues in the States and, you know, the kind of limited progress we've been able to make. And then at the same time, I'd been living abroad. I've lived abroad for quite a few years in a number of countries, about 8 countries. And I felt like there were these stories that had been successful that I was experiencing firsthand that I really wanted to share with my fellow Americans so that we could fight for something similar. And the personal side, which I'm sure you read about in the book, it comes down to a health incident in my family. So my mom, who was an undocumented immigrant from Mexico for quite a few years, couldn't afford health insurance for most of her life and had undiagnosed, untreated diabetes that got really out of hand to the point where she called me from an emergency room when I was in grad school saying that they had to amputate her right foot. And before then, she hadn't been able to see a doctor for years. So at the time, I had lived, I had scholarships to go to college. I was the first in my family to get a college degree. And I had studied abroad in a couple of countries that had universal healthcare. And I started to think about how frustrating it was at the same time that I was really worried about my mom and her health and all of these issues that she had, that I also had no idea how we were going to be able to afford her care and her insulin, for example, and that just wasn't an issue that people in the countries that I had lived in had.
I happen to be going to a meeting later this week in Cuba, where I know that the hospitals have treatments for diabetes that can prevent some amputations, but you can't import that to the United States because it's more important to cut off and punish Cuba, right? So sometimes there's real resistance to learning something from another country.
Yeah, it's a shame, though, because there are so many lessons to learn. I mean, the whole book is kind of based on this idea that if we really just learn from successes, right? I looked at policies from a wide range of countries. I didn't just go to Scandinavia. That's often the case with, you know, when we talk about social democratic policies, we'd look at Scandinavian countries, and I did go to a couple, as you know, but I wanted to go, you know, I went to Uruguay, I went to New Zealand, I went to Singapore. I wanted to take a really global look at how other countries are solving issues that in the States feel intractable sometimes.
Do you want to just list the dozen or so model successes from around the world that make up the book?
Yeah, sure. So I kind of took this crypt to crypt kind of look at policies. And I started with universal healthcare. I live in the UK, so I looked at their National Health Service, which is the first in the world to have a nationwide universal healthcare system. I looked at family-friendly policies in Norway, something that we really desperately need in the US. I looked at Finland's amazing public education system that has universal public education for all and outperforms American students. I might forget a few. There are 9 in total. I went to Uruguay to look at how they greened their grid in less than 10 years with considerably less resources than we have. Singapore has this incredible public house, universal public housing story where they've essentially eradicated homelessness and made homeowners of the majority of their citizens. New Zealand has a beloved universal pension system that we could learn a lot from. And yeah, I think I'm, oh, Portugal has a great drug decriminalization program and harm reduction and treatment program. Those are just a few.
I think Costa Rica's biodiversity law and
That's right.
Estonia's internet policies are in there too, maybe some others. It's an incredible list. And some of them, like the public health coverage in the UK, it seems have been learned from by a few countries, and perhaps by every single wealthy country on earth except for one, whereas others are unique and nobody's copied them and nobody's learned from them. What makes the difference?
It's really incredible because there are some places. So, for example, I visited so many Finnish public schools, and oftentimes teachers there were telling me, we're actually implementing theories and approaches that American scholars have come up with. They're
Sure.
just not getting to apply them in their classrooms because of the way that education is structured in the US. And so, it's this kind of funny thing where the ideas are there in the US. And one of the great things that happened as well while I was researching this book is that I noticed that not only are other people like me looking abroad for examples like these, but they're actually starting to build policies based on some of these. So, for example, Senator Chang out of Honolulu, a local representative there, he has modeled a policy for public housing. For based on Singapore's public housing model. And so, this it's not just that we're not learning and we refuse to learn. People are starting to. It's sort of a matter of political will, leadership, building broader movements.
And the stories that you tell are not just of phenomenal successes and what the finished product is, what it looks like to have a national green energy policy or a sensible internet policy or health coverage for everybody, far cheaper than not having health coverage for everybody, but also how they got there. Like, there's a lot in here of what it took, years and decades of failures and retries. What did you learn about what it takes to get to one of these?
A lot of people started to ask me as I was working on this book, sort of, what are the lessons that I learned from all of the countries? And I certainly learned you definitely need, leadership. We need political allies. We need public ownership over private profit. That was a big one. When talking about Uruguay, I mean, they have a publicly owned electric utility that was key to such a rapid energy transition. But one of the things that I really want people to remember right now is that a lot of these solutions came out of really dark periods in these countries' histories. So we talk about the National Health Service in the UK that actually came out of the ashes of World War II. There was the sense that they needed to rebuild the country and they had to re-envision what kind of country they wanted to rebuild. And part of that was a more equitable healthcare system that they felt was at the core of things. A lot of Uruguay had financial crises every single time they had droughts, and the droughts were getting, more frequent and worse because of climate change. And they just felt that they could not survive economically if they didn't deal with their energy crisis. And a number of these of other countries, Estonia, Finland, they turned to very different policies to address the fact that they were small economies that needed to grow. And they all did so really successfully. And so that's kind of one of the key lessons. The other thing is that most, if not all, of these policies have broad support across the political spectrum. So they may not have started that way, but they certainly now are mostly incredibly popular. And for example, in Norway, You couldn't dream of taking away paid parental leave because people just love it. They understand the impact of it.
Where we have had successful policies in the United States, I'm thinking of Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, some more successful than others. Social Security maybe is at the top there. The corrupt politicians still want to take it away, even though it's been incredibly popular for so many years. And it seems to me like one of the things that makes some things popular that applies to most, if not all, of these successes that we ought to be studying, is that they're universal. They're not means tested. They're not affirmative action designed. They're just everybody gets it. Even the billionaires get this teeny little subsidy that they won't even notice, but the people who desperately need it get it too, but it's universal. Do you think there's an advantage to that? Because who am I, as the white guy, to say we shouldn't be focused on reparations for slavery and reparations for this and reparations for that? But these policies that are universal seem to actually succeed and last. What do you think?
Definitely. There's a problem at the core of American society, which is that if you're extremely wealthy, you have an off-ramp. You can afford the best of everything: healthcare, childcare, elder care, housing. But the rest of American society, despite living in the wealthiest country in the history of the planet, does not have access or has very limited access to these same things. And so I'm a big believer in universal programs. I can really see, and I saw in all of these countries, how not providing those off ramps builds this social solidarity that means that, as you said, billionaires have to use the same healthcare system. So they're invested in its success. You see that with everything from public school, universal public school education to universal pensions. If you don't allow people to opt out, it means that everyone is in it together. But it's also not just better from an equity standpoint, I really believe, it's also less wasteful. A lot of these policies, I mean, we waste so many resources, so much time and money on means testing, which is often, the line of what's below the poverty line is can be arbitrary, can leave people out that really need help. And when you have universal programs, you just cut out a ton of needless admin and waste. So I definitely agree that universality is the key. And the other thing to remember is that it doesn't have to stop there. We don't have to stop say, okay, this is universal, and therefore we can't consider questions of intersectionality with race or gender. The National Health Service is a really good example of that, where it's a universal healthcare system for free at the point of delivery for everyone who lives in the UK. And throughout the years, they've been fighting to make it more equitable for everyone. And so I think, but they don't have a problem with access. So already that makes it more equitable from the word go,
Right, which getting rid of the private health insurance companies in the US that you pay an extra 50% for the service of trying to figure out how to screw you out of getting health coverage, would be more efficient, more equitable, cheaper. You'd think people who want to save money would actually like that. The book is called Another World Is Possible: Lessons for America from Around the Globe by our guest Natasha Hakimi Zapata. Part of what I like about the book, and what I like in general, is debunking BS. And of course, when you ask people, corrupt people in Washington, D.C., to look at success stories from around the world, say, why can't we do that here? They have some standard excuses usually that don't hold up to scrutiny, right?
Definitely. You've heard them as much as I have. Oh, the US is too diverse and too populous to be able to have things like universal healthcare or universal public education. And I really find this just disingenuous. I think diversity is a great strength of our country, and we have huge financial and human resources in the US that are really being squandered or being wasted. And I've started to reframe the question as, Why is it that tiny Uruguay, for example, with considerably less resources, is able to green its grid in less than a decade? And we, with all of the money and technology and again, human resources that we have, aren't able to. It just doesn't really make sense when you think of it that way.
Well, one problem I think that may be a legitimate concern is that your average person in the US uses tons more energy than your average person in Uruguay. But the US hasn't even gone so far as to green the amount of energy per person that your average Uruguayan uses, right? Not even close.
Right. It's clear that we use a lot more energy than most other countries in the world, and even on a per capita basis. I'm sure there's a lot of work to do on that as well. But if we even just started with greening a much larger percentage of our grid, we would be in a much better place. And there was a study out of Oxford a few years ago that talked about how we could save trillions of dollars by the year 2050 if we implemented renewable energy across the board and ditched fossil fuels. So it's an economic question, and this is something that was really interesting in Uruguay, is that I had to kind of push people to talk to me about climate change. Most of the people I was talking to about renewable energy were talking about, the technology and the economics of it and how much money they were saving and how many jobs they were creating. And really, it didn't, climate change was kind of a last concern because, like you said, they don't consume as much energy as we do. Their carbon footprints aren't as big. And so they weren't really doing this for that reason.
The thing I like about a lot of these policies is that they have side effects that are all beneficial, right? I think if we had greener energy, less pollution, cost of healthcare would go down too, because people wouldn't be getting sick who live anywhere near all the current sources of U.S. energy. If we had, better healthcare, better housing, et cetera, the problems of dealing with drugs, the question of improving education, these things all benefit each other. And so it seems to me the excuse that, oh, well, these other societies are safer and better off, and US streets are dangerous, and we can't just let kids roam around. These are problems created by the failure to have these sensible policies, right?
Absolutely. And as you're saying, a lot of these issues intersect with one another. And so I really call for doing it all. And I know that sounds extremely ambitious, but I really think that we're up for it. And we're at a point in American history in which we can't afford not to. It's actually the way of the, our way of life is unaffordable at this point, in that, as you're pointing out, people are unhoused because of our policies, they are falling ill because of our policies, and then not being able to get treatment. They're being poorly, if not educated. There are just so many problems in the US that really are not intractable. And I know because I witnessed firsthand and I talked to citizens, I include a lot of stories from just everyday people in this book that are living with these policies and really appreciate them. And so I really want us to go away thinking about how we can be inspired and how we can build broader coalitions around certain issues. The other thing I think is really important is that there's this sort of myth in the US that we pay less tax and that's why we can't have such nice things. And it's a myth. It's completely untrue. Matt Brunig has this great piece in Jacobin Magazine from a few years ago, actually, in which he talks about how if you take into account health insurance payments as part of a labor tax rate, because the Affordable Care Act means that you can't really opt out of it anyway, so it should be considered part of the labor tax rate. And you compare that to other countries in the OECD, we actually have one of the highest labor tax rates in the world, in the developed world, in the OECD. And so Norway, where you have the universal healthcare system and these amazing family-friendly policies, subsidized childcare, they pay about 32% of labor tax rate, and we pay about 43%. So we're not paying less tax, we just have a bad deal.
And we don't have the corporations and the billionaires pay that rate. We just have the rest of us pay it. The thing we're going to see in the coming months, I'm afraid, in Washington, D.C., under this sort of cult of idiocracy that's been installed with these oligarchs running the show, is the exact opposite of what we should be learning here, that we're going to see a so-called reconciliation bill that's supposedly just about spending money, not policies. That's going to put everything into the military, take it out from of everything else, take away what taxes are left on the corporations and the wealthy. I hope that people who favor all of these things can unite in opposing that. But can we go to the state level? Can we do some of these things in individual US states? I mean, what is the good of knowing all these wonderful things are happening around the world? The environment wouldn't be going off the cliff if anybody learned from Uruguay, if it's just a tragedy, if we can't act on it.
Absolutely. I'm fully aware that on a national scale, we are probably facing a period in which we're going to make very little progress, if not go backwards on some issues. But I think that a lot of things can be implemented on a state level, on a local level. Like I said, there are already people on a local level looking at things like Singapore's public housing for Hawaii or for Honolulu. And so it doesn't mean that just because we start on a local or a state level that we can't later move to a nationwide level. One of the good news that came out of the general election in November, which I was really heartened to see, was that you saw states like that we would consider deep red states, right? Like Mississippi, Alaska, and Nebraska, passing paid sick leave policies on the state ballot. And with huge majorities, right? I think in Nebraska, it was something like 74% of the vote went towards passing it. So these are what we would consider traditionally progressive policies, but they're actually not about right or left. If we look at results like this, they're popular across the political spectrum. And when we talk about fighting for these issues and coming together and wanting to implement all of these things, I think that we're always going to meet people that don't agree with us on everything. I believe in all of the policies that I looked at, the nine policies I looked at in this book. If one person picks up the book and is interested in one or two of the policies, I would hope that that would be enough to start fighting for one of those issues and perhaps later another one. Or maybe they'll pick up the book and read about renewable energy and actually get interested in paid family leave. Who knows? But it seems small scale, but it's something that we need to start doing, and we need to move beyond who's in the White House, beyond electoral politics, and really think about how we can come together as citizens to fight for a different vision for the US.
I think we also saw states vote for better minimum wage, for marijuana legalization, et cetera, who voted for, in at least in some cases, for whichever horrible politicians you think are the worst of the bunch. And so I wonder, are there states pursuing some of these policies with some success? I mean, universal health care, we've seen resistance by the federal government to allowing states to do it. We've seen states, California, whenever the governor's a Republican, the legislature will pretend they want it. Family-friendly policies, public housing, good schools, good drug policies. I mean, some of these things could be done at the state level, but are they happening? Where should we be looking to out of the 50 states?
There are a ton of success stories in the US. I hope to one day write a book about those too. I think that there's a lot there, and I'm really heartened by the fact that there is movement in that direction on a lot of these issues in plenty of places. So again, I've mentioned Hawaii a few times, but there's a similar public housing policy based on Singapore that a state senator in California is looking at. There are This is almost a cautionary tale in that Oregon implemented drug decriminalization, and it was kind of ineffective and scapegoated, and a ton of other issues happened with it. But I really admire that they tried to do it, and that they showed us that we actually have to implement and internalize the right lessons from these policies. Sometimes it'll take some trial and error. But there's this great quote by Nyrin Bevan, who is the founder of the National Health Service in the UK, where he talks about how at some point, the NHS was going to become so popular that even our enemies were going to start taking credit for it. And I really believe that if we move forward on these issues, it's going to be really hard to take them away because people are going to realize how great they are, and we can always make them better. And that's something that I tell, Brits all the time when here in the UK, when they can complain about their health. Healthcare, like we do in the US as well, for different reasons. And I say, well, but it's yours. You can complain about it, and you can, join a movement that tries to improve it and to make sure to keep it public because it is yours. It belongs to the British people. Our healthcare system in the US does not belong to us. I don't, these ho private hospitals and health insurance companies don't belong to us. They belong to their shareholders.
But this is, we have just a couple minutes left. Natasha Hakimi Zapata, this is what Europe is up against now, right? Trump is demanding 5% of economies into military. The nations are racing each other to see who can do it first, Lithuania or Poland or somebody else, the Scandinavia, they're covering their countries with US military bases. Denmark is not saying, hey, you should be learning from us. They're saying, hey, yeah, you want to cover Greenland with military bases? Please. Let us help you. Like, this is the opposite of learning, right? This is Europe taking US lessons of failure rather than the US taking Scandinavian lessons of success. So, how is this going to play out?
As much as I'm heartened by all the progress we're making in the US on certain issues that we were just talking about, I'm obviously disheartened by the direction that some European countries are taking in recent years. You have Hungary and Italy moving further and further right. Germany, there's the rise of the right. There are a lot of, for lack of a better word, scary things happening in Europe, as much as in the US. And it's a terribly regressive to move towards more militarization instead of actually trying to heal the very real social ills that, again, already have solutions and are better for everyone. I hope, and I'm a very hopeful person, as you can probably tell from this book and from our conversation, that, as I said before, dark periods can actually yield some of the most hopeful solutions. That this is a period that we're going to look at the situation in front of us in Europe, in the US, elsewhere, and think, actually, this is not what we want. That we need to learn how to get out of this darkness and never come back in.
Well, I highly recommend that we start by reading this book, Another World is Possible: Lessons for America from Around the Globe by Natasha Hakimi Zapata. If you want to know what to do with the internet, with drug policy, with health policy, you don't have to invent it. It's out there, public success, no copyrights on it. Take it and use it. And it's in this book. Natasha, thank you for writing the book and for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you so much, David. It's been great.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.